The Electoral College is casting its votes today for the next president of the United States. Voting continues until early tonight. It's usually a formality. The electoral tally is expected to once again confirm President-elect Joe Biden's victory. Wisconsin's 10 electors voted earlier today, just an hour after the state Supreme Court rejected an attempt by the Trump campaign to throw out over 200,000 ballots in two counties. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling now that Wisconsin's electoral votes are officially cast? Do you have questions about what happens next? Do you think President Trump's allegations of fraud will keep impacting our politics in the years to come? If you voted for President Trump, do you want Republican lawmakers and others to find more ways to challenge the results, or do you think it's time to move on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Maurice Shepard is an instructor of political science at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, Maurice, this is usually a formality. We don't usually pay this much attention to the Electoral College, you know, casting the ballots that we knew they were going to cast weeks ago. It is getting more attention this year. Could you talk a little bit about why people are focused so much on today?
Well, in terms of President Trump, he has really placed a spotlight on the entire process, on the electoral process, how campaigns are actually conducted, and actually how votes are counted. So, unlike most other presidential election cycles, we're paying extra attention this time to the actual mechanics of electing a president in a way that we haven't before.
Talk about where the mechanics go from here. As anticipated, states are casting their votes. Eventually, at some point, we'll hit the point where President-elect Biden has the official electoral votes to win the presidency. What happens then between now and Inauguration Day?
Right. So today, what happened is, again, the electors in each state met. They cast their ballots in each state. They will have a certificate of vote. That's sort of the formal official record of, once again, the electors for each state. There'll be six copies of those. Just as an interesting note here, the certificate of vote and all the other materials are available publicly in the National Archives. So if anyone's really interested in seeing the actual document, the signatures and everything, they're on there. So those six copies will be distributed to the vice president, who is also the president of the Senate, the archivist of the United States, the Wisconsin Secretary of State, and also to the closest U.S. District Court. And those certificates have to be distributed by December 23rd. So there's a deadline coming up before we get to January 6th. After that, we move to the joint session of Congress on January 6th. 2021, where the new Congress will be in place, and they will then actually go through the formal process of counting the Electoral College votes.
And as you say, the formal process, but at each point now, there's been a challenge and there's talk, and this has happened before and it didn't go anywhere, where some members of Congress challenged the electoral count as it came in. And we're expecting to see at least some of that from some Republican members of Congress this year. What kind of things are on the table there?
Well, there's a lot that can happen. Again, a lot of this is very transparent. We can go back and look at the electoral count for the 2016 presidential election. And at that time, the Democrats, they did provide some disruption to a usually quiet process in terms of allegations of, again, sort of voter fraud and these sorts of things. So the expectation is going into, again, this upcoming count of the vote that Republicans will challenge, again, some of the returns from the different states. And at the joint session, it's the vice president that will once again preside over the operations, and also that'll be Vice President Mike Pence. He will have a group of tellers that will read each state's electoral vote. And when those votes are read, then there is an opportunity at that point for members of Congress and their formal challenge rules, where you can make a challenge in terms of a state's electoral vote, The key here in terms of the standards is that if it requires two members of Congress, one member from the House of Representatives and one from the Senate, and they have to have a written objection laying out, again, that for whatever reason, there's something irregular or not proper about the vote. And if there is one member from the House and one member from the Senate, and they have a written objection, they can actually slow this down. I think according to the rules, they will have to recess for a maximum of 2 hours in both chambers to review the allegations, the charges. And the only way that according to the rules, that a state's votes can be excluded is if both chambers vote and agree to exclude those votes, which doesn't seem very likely since the Democrats will have control of the House. And we're still uncertain about the Senate right now.
Talking to Maurice Shepherd from Madison College, political scientist there, looking at today's Electoral College voting and what happens next between now and Inauguration Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maurice, once the Electoral College voting is done, do you think it's likely that Republicans will start to back away from their challenges to the election, even if the Trump campaign itself doesn't? There's a new lawsuit, I think, today in New Mexico, for example. Do you think that this will be a turning point in the conversation?
Just in terms of politics, as Machiavelli would say, all politics is short term. I think ultimately what will happen is the Republican Party will go back to its conservative roots, conservative ideology. There'll be some members of the Republican Party that have a more reactionary ideology. They may not be as willing to sort of settle down. But I think ultimately there will be an acceptance of Joe Biden as the legitimate president of the United States.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Say, what happened over the weekend with the Supreme Court pretty much indicates it was garbage in, and the court threw it out as garbage. And frankly, I think a lot of the garbage was sour grapes by the Republicans. They really had no substance, no witnesses. So I just think it's sour grapes on their part.
Bob, thanks for the call. And Maurice, we had a lot of court cases, and as Bob indicated, basically no wins for President Trump. One small one when it came to setting aside a small number of votes in Pennsylvania in case they were successfully challenged later, but not really much came through the courts on President Trump's side.
Yeah, and I think Bob is right in terms of, again, sort of the quality of the evidence simply wasn't there. I will say, however, that one thing that could happen is with all of these court cases, regardless of the actual outcome of the cases, one thing that the Republicans are doing that may actually be beneficial to everyone is putting a light on our voting administration, electoral rules, and things of that nature. That even though, again, they have the Trump team has not been successful in court, in the long run, there may be some benefit here in terms of making sure that we take a proper look at our rules and regulations as they relate to voting and elections.
And one thing this reveals once again is elections are run at the state and local level. There's not a nationwide standard. Each state can do things differently and often localities within that. And I think, Maurice, is it fair to say that's led to some confusion for people looking at a state that does things differently and assuming that they're doing it wrong?
Exactly right, Rob. There's an issue in terms of political knowledge and what I would call sort of political intelligence. A lot of people get a lot of political information, but they don't really understand how it all fits together. As you're pointing out, a key here is the issue of federalism, that that we have American federalism. We have a national government, state and local governments. The two work together, but there are also areas where the two are separated. The Constitution makes it clear that in terms of the administration of elections, it is up to state governments to handle that. So as you point out, there have been a number of individuals that somehow make the assumption that, oh, if the national government just comes in, it can sort of take over the process. But that is constitutionally, that is not going to happen.
We're talking to Maurice Shepard, political science instructor at Madison College, looking at today's Electoral College vote ongoing. Wisconsin's electors have already cast their votes. And what's next in the transition process and where the political parties are headed from here? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the process? Do you have thoughts on the politics? Do you want to see more challenges to this year's election results? Are there changes you'd like to see or clarifications you'd like to see on our voting process here in Wisconsin? Even if it doesn't change election 2020, do you think things need to be more clear? Are there things that you think we're doing wrong right now that you'd like to fix? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farid. We pick up our conversation now with Maurice Shepard from Madison College, political scientist there, talking about what's next in the presidential transition process as the Electoral College vote continues around the country today. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Green Bay. Scott, hi. Scott, are you there? I don't know. Let's try Steve in Danbury. Steve, hello.
Hi. There's been no fraud uncovered. There's been no cheating uncovered. And these sinister allegations that Trump's been making for over a month now have done nothing but unravel the rather delicate strands that are holding our democracy together right now. And Senator Ron Johnson has been at the forefront of all this and now has indicated that he won't rule out challenging the results in Congress on January 6th.
Steve, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Maurice, Steve raising the concern that the constant allegations of widespread fraud without proof of widespread fraud could be damaging to our system of representative government, Maurice.
Yes, I think Steve is onto something there. There can be, there's a difference between conditions and problems. A condition you can live with and you can manage. When you have a problem, now you really have to put resources toward it. So we have issues within our election, voting and election process. I don't know necessarily if they rise to the level of problem. But Steve is right, though. Having this, you know, once again, these allegations, they're dangerous. They can weaken collective belief in the American political institutions, in political science and comparative politics in particular, when we try to identify what we might identify as sort of a weak state. Some might be Russia, Brazil, Nigeria, for example. One of the hallmarks of that is the lack of strong popular support in the belief that the government is legitimate, or there's serious, once again, issues in terms of the legitimacy of the government. So I don't think we are there yet, but you know, this is a dangerous path to go down.
Thanks for the call, Steve. We'll go to Sue next with us in Amherst. Hi, Sue. Oh, Sue, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go. What did you want to ask about, Sue, or bring up?
I'm sorry. A little connectivity issue. My interest in this entire process is simple. They're really the timeline has not allowed for in-depth investigation into any of the allegations yet. They have been summarily dismissed by multiple courts as saying that the evidence is too thin and et cetera. And of course, there hasn't really been an honest media dialogue. One commentator or news anchor after another simply dismisses the accusations as lies, et cetera, and on we go. I am extremely concerned that down the road somewhere, some of these accusations are going to be found to be true. There are sworn affidavits of good people that saw things happen, and they have been dismissed.
Sue, thanks a lot for the call. Maurice, can you talk about that a little? There have been affidavits in some of these cases where judges said these people didn't establish actual instances of fraud. Can you talk a little bit about Sue's concern, though?
Sure. And I think, and Sue has a point there, particularly in terms of, again, that there may be, and there's actually in the political science literature studies that show there's one thing to have sort of criminality, once again, corruption in the political election process. There's another in terms of having unclear administrative rules and regulations that are that may be unintentionally sort of broken and may lead to bad outcomes. So I would say in response to and to follow up just on what Sue said is that there probably should be after all of this is over, it should be once again, I think, a federal grant system where the federal government provides states resources so that state governments, either individually or working together, can look at, again, improving and modernizing our campaign and election system. What I'm talking about, this is nothing new. Following the 2000 presidential election, Bush v. Gore, that's exactly what the government did with the what's called the HAVA Act, the Help America Vote Act, that the federal government provided state governments across the country funding to help modernize the voting equipment and also look at developing better ballot design. I think we may need something along those lines after this election cycle sort of wraps up. I'd like to call it a HAVA 2.0.
In our last minute or so, Maurice, what are you looking for when it comes to possible changes, maybe in states like Wisconsin, where there is this post-election dispute over some of those procedures you were just talking about and how state statutes were interpreted by the Wisconsin Elections Commission?
Sure. At the state level here in Wisconsin, I think one thing that we can do is perhaps reexamine, once again, the state election regulatory oversight. We used to have the Government Accountability Board that was replaced with the new Elections Commission. You know, we may need to look at that agency again to see exactly is it properly staffed? Do they have enough, once again, resources and equipment? And also, again, get feedback from voters in terms of what are some of the issues that they witnessed, as Sue pointed out. And what can we do to, again, make sure that we have free and fair democratic elections in Wisconsin?
Maurice, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Maurice Shepherd is an instructor of political science at Madison College. He talked to us about what's next in the lead up to Inauguration Day after electors in Wisconsin and the rest of the country cast their votes today for the next president. Edward Anderson was a dairy farmer, a father, and a veteran of World War II. He died in November from COVID-19. He was 97 years old. This week, as we approach the end of 2020, WPR is profiling some of the people we lost to the pandemic. Rob Mentzer has this remembrance.
Edward Anderson spent 4 months as a prisoner of war. It was 1944 and the prison camps were full, so the Nazis forced him and about 2,000 other American captives to march for hundreds of miles. When they ate anything, they ate grass soup. Ed kept a secret diary of his time as a prisoner. His daughter, Sandra Cherney, still has it. On the back of it, he wrote a list of foods he imagined eating when he got home.
Tapioca pudding. And he had pie, apple pie, cheese.
Ed grew up on a dairy farm in Barron County. He was 20 years old when he was drafted to fight in World War II. He was captured in Belgium in the Battle of the Bulge. A newsreel from 1944 documented the battle for Americans at home.
The Nazi Party is willing to sacrifice every building and every soul in Germany to stave off defeat. War is conducted in mist and turmoil and uncertainty.
We were running out of food, ammunition, what have you. I ended up with a bunch of wounded down in the basement of a house, and that's where the Germans found me.
There aren't any recordings of Edward Anderson, but in 1991, his friend Wayne Erickson gave an oral history interview to the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. The two men grew up 10 miles away from each other, but they met as prisoners of war. Erickson died in 2003. Of the thousands captured, Erickson said fewer than 500 survived.
Well, some just collapsed, some were shot, some froze to death, some, we have no way of knowing what happened to some. Some we do, but some we don't.
Ed weighed less than 100 pounds when American troops liberated them. He came home and got married. He took over the dairy farm from his dad, and he drove a milk truck. Ed and his wife had two kids, Sandra and her brother Lee, who died in a motorcycle accident in 1973. Sandra says when she was a child, her father was always very busy. He didn't talk much and never talked about the war.
He was a man of very few words when it came to talking about himself.
She was an adult when she learned about his experiences. And in 2016, the Barron County Veterans Service Office and a congressman presented Ed with a POW medal. He enjoyed the ceremony, Sandra says, but he was still reserved. He didn't speak except to say thank you. Sandra is 74 now. She lives in Texas, but she video chatted with her dad regularly. In early November, she and the staffers at his nursing home were making plans to celebrate his birthday.
By 5 that afternoon, they called me. It was about 4:45, and they said, your dad's running a fever. We're going to do the fast test, which they did, and he was positive.
Ed had COVID-19.
He did live through the night. I FaceTimed with him in the afternoon of the next day, and he lived one more day. He lived 48 hours after he contracted the virus.
Sandra says she knew her dad could go at any time, but it was still a shock. He was doing well for his age. Sandra was looking forward to visiting him in 2021. It feels unfair that the pandemic took him. She thought she'd have a few more years with him. Ed died 2 weeks before his 98th birthday. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.